coming up next. It's story time, but let the man introduce it.
Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. I propose this evening to attend to a little story and, as we often do, see what happens if we really attend and open up to the possibilities of the story. I have in mind a story from the Bible, a very minor little episode, one that's not generally known and one you may or may not be pleased to hear, one that people who take the Bible too earnestly will find somewhat scandalous. The story breaks the bounds of what earnest people would call honest morality, and it's also funny once we can discover the humor hidden in the text. And then after this, I'll give you a modern fairy tale that's somewhat connected to the first story, but is certainly interesting in its own right. So that's what we'll be attending to this evening under lamplight. And, of course, you are invited to attend too. Now first, the story of Ehud. Who? See, I told you wouldn't know the story. It's really just a little folk tale placed in the Book of Judges to help develop the overall idea of the Book of Judges, which is concerned with the growing chaos of the Israelites after they settled uneasily in the Promised Land. But before we move on, I need to acknowledge that many people, maybe you included, have had such horrible experiences with the Bible, which was thrust at them from a young age like a solid stone pill they had to take for the good of their soul, or like a cudgel that people in authority used to keep them in line, or else. It's all very bleak, dogmatic, and rigid. But the thing is, I'm sure that none of those people who push the Bible like this have even ever heard of the story of Ehud. It doesn't promote their agenda. But second, as I hope to show, the Bible is much more lively, flexible, and witty than those people think it is. And the story of Ehud reads more like an after-dinner story from some older culture than like anything people have been indoctrinated into thinking the Bible is all about. Okay, so, if you're one of those who has sworn never again to go anywhere near the Bible, break that oath for a few minutes and see what we have to show you this evening under lamplight. And to put us all at ease, why not come on over here to the comfy chairs under lamplight so we can sit together with the story of Ehud. The story of Ehud is found in one of the early chapters of the Book of Judges, which is an odd book in the Bible. There's no main character, just a succession of incidents about the struggles faced by the Israelites when they settled in Canaan. But there is a pattern to the succession of incidents. It goes like this. The Israelites, a loose confederation of allied tribes, forsake their covenant with the Lord, following their own desires, and probably adopting local Canaanite deities. The Lord then raises up an enemy who defeats the Israelites and rules over them, demanding tribute and other acts of subservience. After a number of years of oppression, the people repent, which means they turn around, they change their ways. They remember the covenant, and the Lord is pleased and raises up a judge, a kind of military leader, to deliver them. They win their freedom and have a number of years of prosperity before they once again follow their own ways and start the cycle all over again. That's the pattern, and and we should recognize it as a pattern found in most cultures throughout history. Prosperity leading to a kind of smugness and selfish abandonment of cultural values, leading to a collapse of the country, until finally the people wake up and reassert their old values. And then, well, then it goes around again. There, to dramatize the pattern of going round and round, was the Hora Stokata by Grigoraj Dinitku, arranged by Yasha Heifetz, played by Michael Rabin. Back to our text. One characteristic of the Hebrew writers of the Bible is a literary device we call reticence. That is, they don't tell us very much. We get a basic story with no details, unless these details are of a special importance. The way we read such a story, therefore, is first of all to take note of the details we are given and then play with the possibilities lying below the surface of the bare text. This kind of writing makes us work for its meaning. We have to provide the description and connection ourselves, and also the motives. You'll see what I mean. And the story begins with the word "and," linking it to the previous story and suggesting that here is just another part of a larger story, following from what went before, leading into what goes next, round and round. Well, here goes. "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And he gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and went and smote Israel, and possessed the city of palm trees. So the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord raised them up a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a man left-handed. And by him the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab."
Mm-hmm.
That was Daphne Sade and the Voyagers with the first part of their Middle Eastern tango. I think we'll let this piece accompany us through our reading of the story of Ehud. Back to the story. The storyteller doesn't mess around. He gets right to the point. The Israelites did evil, and the Lord raised up an enemy against them. And notice the fancy literary wit here, too. It's what we call, well, what I call anyway, a sandwich effect. The writer says one thing, says something else, and repeats the first thing as though sandwiching the main event inside two statements of what gave cause to the event. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. That's the King James translation, preserving the Hebrew wit. Many, I'm afraid, many modern versions are a little too earnest to play around like this. Now, who is this Eglon? A king of the hostile neighboring people, the Moabites, who then allies with other people hostile to the Israelites, the Ammonites and the Amalekites, and together they all defeat the Israelites, and for 18 years the Israelites were oppressed by Eglon and the Moabites. The original audience of this tale would have seen a joke here. Eglon, the king's name, means fatted calf. That is, the animal you feed up to be killed on a special occasion, a big feast, or perhaps a sacrifice at the altar of the Lord. At this point, all we have is the king's name, but keep this detail in mind and see what develops. And then comes our hero, Ehud. We're told two things about him. He's a Benjamite, and he is left-handed. Being a Benjamite means he comes from the tribe of Benjamin, the smallest of the 12 tribes of Israel. And being left-handed means that he is something of a freak, maybe even a bit of an outcast, as anyone with unusual characteristics might have been in those days. It's not unusual, as any reader of folk tales and fairy tales knows, to find the outcast turning into the person who saves the situation. But why in such a sparse story are we told that he's left-handed? Well, again, just keep this detail in mind and see what happens. But also don't miss the pun here. Benjamin means son of my right hand. So Ehud is one of the sons of my right hand, but he's left-handed. All right, that's not great irony, but enough of an ironic touch to remind us that we need our wits about us as we keep listening. It was Ehud, we're told, who went up to the court of Eglon to present the tribute to the king. Maybe this was money, maybe grain and oil, maybe jewelry. We're not told. And we're not told either whether Ehud goes there as a solitary emissary or as the leader of a whole procession of Israelites delivering the present? Though the answer will become clear a little later. But before Ehud sets off for Eglon's court, we're told one more thing. Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges of a cubit length, and he did gird it under his raiment upon his right thigh. What's all this about the dagger? Something sneaky, of course, but what exactly? The dagger is of a cubit length, which I understand is about a foot long, or for those of you who need it the other way, about, I think, 30 centimeters long. Though it's not clear if the whole dagger is this long, or just the blade, probably just the blade, in which case it's pretty long for a dagger. And why the two sharp edges? What's he going to use it for? But most puzzling, why did he gird it under his clothes against his right thigh? Why tell us that? So now here's Ehud, showing up at King Eglon's court to offer the present, the tribute. We're not given any description of the scene, but if we're going to make this come alive, we have to conjure up some sort of picture, or perhaps a series of different plausible pictures. The king surely sits amid a great deal of splendor, proclaiming his mighty importance. He's on a throne, I imagine, but is it a raised throne? And do we approach the throne down a line of attendant courtiers? Or maybe it's a more military atmosphere, and there are soldiers lined up against the walls. Maybe there's music being played. Maybe the sweet smell of some kind of incense. It's all very exotic. And what does Ehud look like? Well, I see two possibilities. His chief concern is to deflect any suspicion on the Moabites' part and to appear unassuming and non-threatening. Does he then come splendidly apparelled, looking like every other courtier so that he does not stand out in the crowd? Or does he perhaps come dressed in rustic clothes, looking like some downtrodden country rustic, cowed by the great scene before him, submissively presenting his tribute and then awkwardly leaving the place? We're not told, of course. Either picture will do, I think. But what we surely have to imagine is that the palace security guards look him over for any potential weapons. Perhaps they frisk him, but only on his left side, the side where any proper right-handed man would keep his sword. No, it's okay, sir. No weapons on him. He's clean. But of course, we know he's coming armed with that long, sharp dagger on the other side. So now, dramatic irony starts building up. Dramatic irony is the situation when the audience or reader knows more about what's going on than the characters in the story. And then, as he is presenting the tribute to the king, we get another unexpected detail almost casually thrown in. And he brought the present unto Eglon, king of Moab, and Eglon was a very fat man. Eglon was a very fat man, was he? Well, we know by now to pay attention to every detail we're given. And of course, it's just what we'd expect a man whose name means fatted calf to look like. A nice little joke for the original listeners to the story. And now the action speeds up a little. But when he had made an end to offer the present, he sent away the people that bear the present. But he himself turned again from the quarries that were by Gilgal and said, I have a secret errand unto thee, O king, who said, keep silence. And all that stood by him went out from him. It's not immediately easy to work out just what's happening here, but let me try to clarify. Ehud offers his tribute and then leaves. We learn incidentally that there are with him the people that bear the present. Maybe it was a huge chest of gold or an ornate statue. But anyway, they all left the court and went as far as what the King James Version calls the quarries, a mistranslation. These were sacred idols, a pagan holy spot found at some distance, I think, from the palace. The whole party went that far, and then Ehud turned back to the palace. The others of the party? Well, let's wait and see. So Ehud returns to the king. What's he doing back here? They all must have asked themselves, and all eyes are on him, and he shouts out, I have a secret errand unto thee, O king. And the king orders everyone to stop their chattering and to leave the room. Why does he do this? Is he so insecure on the throne that he needs any secret advice he can get? Is he so vain that he wants to hear anything that singles him out for special treatment? Has Ehud impressed him so much that he thinks this man is some sort of holy man able to help him out? In any case, this fat calf is stupid, like other world leaders we know today, and apparently is ready to buy anything that will feed his poor ego. Moreover, stupid fool, he is so anxious that no one else listen in to this special message just for him that he orders all his security people out of the room. And now he and Ehud are alone. We know we're coming up to the climax. But before we get back to the action, we're given one more apparently irrelevant detail. The king was sitting in a summer parlor, which he had for himself alone. So they've gone out of the big public room, where someone might be lurking in a corner and overhear what's going on, and have entered the king's private chamber. Okay, now it's set for the climactic action. Be prepared, though, for a little confusion as the storyteller uses he to refer to both Ehud and Eglon. And Ehud said, I have a message from God unto thee. And he arose out of his seat, and Ehud put forth his left hand, and took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And the haft also went in after the blade, and the fat closed upon the blade, so that he could not draw the dagger out of his belly, and the dirt came out. Then Ehud went forth through the porch, and shut the doors of the parlor upon him, and locked them. Again, it's not that easy to catch what happened. Let's try to paint it in more detail. So there we find Ehud and Eglon alone together in that cool, luxurious summer chamber. Eglon is waiting to find out what this secret errand is. Ehud plays on his eagerness with the good news that it's not just a secret message, but one coming straight from God. I have a message from God unto thee. Aha, thinks Eglon, just what I've always been waiting for. I knew it would come someday. God knows how great I am, and now he wants to join forces with me. In fact, he's so eager to hear the message that he gets up from his seat and comes a few steps closer to Ehud. Of course, this is just what Ehud wants. Now, if he suddenly reached with his right hand across to his left side, Eglon, he's not that stupid, would become alarmed that he might be drawing a weapon. But here's where the early detail suddenly reveals its significance. Ehud reaches with his left hand. Not suspicious at all. Maybe he's reaching into a pocket to pull out a scroll with the holy message. It has to be swift and precise. In one smooth movement, he draws the dagger and thrusts it into Eglon's guts, all the way in, so the handle, too, follows through. And remember that other detail. Eglon is very fat. And we're told, in another rare detail, that the fat closed on the blade. That is, there's no way Eglon can ever pull the blade out now, even if that would do him any good. There are some commentators who want to bring out the sexual imagery here, the shaft penetrating the soft flesh. We can keep that in mind if we want, but there's no other sexual significance here, unless we want to say that Ehud is screwing Eglon good and proper. But there's no sense of him planting his seed in the king or anything like that, so I'll just mention this, and let's move on to the next detail, which is a little gruesome, a little disgusting, but crucial to the outcome of the story. The dagger goes into Eglon's guts, and we're told the dirt came out. Dirt in the sense of what was in his bowels. Either it starts leaking out of the wound, or, as sometimes happens in moments of sudden and violent death, he, well, let's use an older word, he beshat himself. In any case, the room begins to stink. Eglon falls down dead, and Ehud goes out the porch door, locks it behind him. It's all been so rapid and silent, and there's no one else around, and Ehud makes his big escape. But that can't be the end of the story. After Ehud has escaped, we're then told, his servants came, and when they saw that, behold, the doors of the parlor were locked, they said, oh, surely he covereth his feet in his summer chamber. And they tarried till they were ashamed, and behold, he opened not the doors of the parlor. Therefore they took a key and opened them, and behold, their lord was fallen down dead on the earth. And Ehud escaped while they tarried. You see what happened. Everyone had to wait downstairs or somewhere while Eglon had his private audience with his special messenger. They waited and waited until at last some of the servants came up to see if everything was all right. They came to the door, however, and found it locked. More than that, though the story doesn't tell us this, we have to remember earlier details and work it out for ourselves. More than that, they can smell that foul odor coming from the summer room. The door and windows were probably vented to provide a cooling breeze in the room, and also, of course, to let out the noxious smell within the room. Okay, they say to each other, trying to work out what's going on, surely he covereth his feet in his summer chamber. Covering your feet is a Hebrew euphemism here for pulling down your garments over your feet as you sit on the can. That's easy to work out, isn't it? So, being polite, they wait till he's finished. But he doesn't come to open the door as they expect, and they soon become ashamed or embarrassed. He's taking a really long time, isn't he? So finally, they take matters into their own hands, get a key, open the door to discover their king lying there dead. All this took a long time, as you can imagine, during which time Ehud was able to escape without anyone pursuing him. Well, that's the story. All the elements of a gripping and witty folk story. But wait, it's not quite over. What does our hero Ehud do next? He's killed the king, but he still has to free his people. He rushes over to the appointed spot, blows a trumpet. Does he have it with him all the time, or has it been placed out there as a kind of long-distance communication tool? And the army of Israelites, maybe even those in that procession bringing the tribute, they're waiting for the signal. They come down from the hills, and with Ehud at their head, they enter the city, which at this moment must be in panicked chaos, with their king mysteriously slain, and they slaughter the Moabites and free themselves from their rule. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, we're told, and the land had rest 80 years. 80, that's 80 years of peaceful prosperity. But remember the cycle that prevails in the book of Judges. Ehud is not going to live forever, and the next thing we hear is, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord when Ehud was dead. And so it goes. Let's hear the rest of the track from Daphne Sadi and the Voyagers, Middle Eastern Tango. And thanks to Daphne Sade and the Voyagers with Middle Eastern Tango from the album Walking the Thin Line. And you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We've been attending to the story of Ehud, a trickster hero from the ancient days. Let's spend a few minutes attending further to the story of Ehud. In its larger political context in the Book of Judges, it's a story about a people in chaos, lurching from one crisis to the next, with no stability, dependent on individual leaders who happen to arise and dispatch the oppressor of the moment. The tide of events depends on the people's relationship to the covenant with their God, whose mighty hand raises up a conqueror or a deliverer, depending on whether they are faithful to the covenant or not. And what is significant, I think, is the way the author or editor expresses the Israelites turning from God. At these times of breaking the covenant, he says, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. This deserves some attention. Obviously, for the writers of the Book of Judges, doing what is right in your own eyes is the worst thing you can do. But what do we today think of that? Well, we today think it's a pretty good idea to do what is right in our own eyes. We reject dogma that is imposed from the outside. We want to check everything ourselves and come to our own conclusions about what is true. This is our inheritance from the Enlightenment, with its strong opposition to any ideas forced upon us by some outside authority. And then there's also this great line from Walt Whitman, which I think most of us would endorse. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book and dismiss whatever insults your own soul. Dismiss whatever insults your own soul. So he tells us to keep whatever pleases our own soul, or, that is, do what is right in our own eyes. Are we then disagreeing with the writers of the Book of Judges who condemn doing what is right in our own eyes? Well, yes, we might think so, but actually I'm not sure. Doing what is right in your own eyes means, I think, at least in the context of the Book of Judges, doing whatever is best for your own situation. That is, whatever works to your own benefit. To live like that is to live a self-centered life, doing right by yourself, even if it means cheating or oppressing others so you can get what you want. Hey, it's my right, in my own eyes anyway, to embezzle £500,000 from my company so I can spend a month at a fancy tropical resort. It's right in my own eyes. Such a view works against traditional moral values, you'll agree, and it leads to political and economic chaos, as we're seeing right now. I won't take this application to modern affairs any further here. You can do that later. So play with that suggested idea. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Every woman, too, of course. Also, no doubt, every child. See where that takes you. But wait, you may ask, doesn't this story itself promote immoral behavior at its very core? It holds up for our approval Ehud, a man who works by deceit to get what he wants. Is that right? Actually, I'm not going to argue the case one way or another, but just to remind you that in most traditional folk literature, including myths and fairy tales, in all these stories, the hero is usually some kind of trickster. Modern films, too. We all go for characters who are sharp and cunning, not so much devious, let's say, as tactical, that is, tacking, not going in a straight line. Oh, yeah, and Columbo, that perennial detective on afternoon television, he's a trickster, too. I could even point out that most of the heroes in the Bible are tricksters, including the character that everyone thinks has died, but who tricks them all and upsets their expectations by leaving his tomb empty. There is, in fact, something holy about this kind of trickster, as testified by most ancient myths having a trickster god. but there's seldom anything holy or held up for admiration in a character who uses trickery for purely selfish ends. And that's where I want to attend to next. But look, what's coming up next is another story. Rather different from the story of Ehud. It's a modern fairy tale written by the excellent Jane Yolen. It's called The River Maid. And it seems pretty obviously a cautionary tale about not raping the natural environment, symbolized by the main character Jan's implied rape of the innocent river maid he keeps imprisoned. But it's also a story about a trickster gone wrong. He does what is right in his own eye, acting out of complete self-interest, using everyone and everything else, and in using them, actually abusing them. He thinks he's a trickster, but tricksters succeed only when they are serving some cause other than themselves. What we have is a reading of the story I recorded several years ago in the studio of Neil Henry's front room. Primitive conditions, but I think it came out okay. The story takes about 16 minutes, but I think you'll find it engrossing. If nothing else, it's full of beautiful imagery. And so, Jane Yolen's The River Maid. The River Maid by Jane Yolen. There was once a rich farmer named Jan who decided to expand his holdings. He longed for the green meadow that abutted his farm with a passion that amazed him. But a swift river ran between the two. It was far too wide and far too deep for his cows to cross. He stood on the riverbank and watched the water hurtle over its rocky course. "I could build a bridge," he said aloud. "But then any fool could do that, and I am no fool." At his words, the river growled, but Jan did not heed it. "No," said Jan with a laugh, "I shall build no bridge across this water. I shall make the river move aside for me." And so he planned how he would dam it up, digging a canal along the outer edge of the meadow, and thus allow his cows the fresh green grass. As if guessing Jan's thought, the river roared out, tumbling its stones in its rush to be heard. But Jan did not understand it. Instead, he left at once to go to the town where he purchased the land and supplies. The men Jan hired dug and dug for weeks, until a deep ditch and a large dam had been built. Then they watched as the river slowly filled up behind the dam, and when, at Jan's signal, the gate to the canal was opened, the river was forced to move into its new course and leave its comfortable old bed behind. At that, Jan was triumphant. He laughed and turned to the waiting men. "See," he called out loudly, "I am not just Jan the farmer, I am Jan the river tamer. A wave of my hand, and the water must change its way." His words troubled the other men. They spat between their fingers and made other signs against the evil eye. But Jan paid them no mind. He was the last to leave the river's side that evening and went home well after dark. The next morning, Jan's feeling of triumph had not faded, and he went down again to the path of the old river, which was now no more than mud and mire. He wanted to look at the desolation and dance over the newly dried stones. But when he got to the river's old bed, he saw someone lying face up in the center of the waterless course.
It was a girl, clothed only in a white shift that clung to her body like a skin. Fearing her dead, Jan ran through the mud and knelt by her side. He put out his hand, but could not touch her. He had never seen anyone so beautiful. Fanned out about her head, her hair was a fleece of gold, each separate strand distinguishable. Fine gold hairs lay molded on her forearms and like wet down upon her legs. On each of her closed eyelids, a drop of river water glistened and reflected back to him his own staring face. At last, Jan reached over and touched her cheek, and at his touch, her eyes opened wide. He nearly drowned in the blue of them. He lifted the girl up in his arms, never noticing how cold her skin or how the mud stuck nowhere to her body or to her shift. And he carried her up onto the bank. She gestured once toward the old riverbank and let out a single, mewling cry. Then she curled in toward his body, nestling, and seemed to sleep. Not daring to wake her again, Jan carried her home and put her down by the hearth. He lit the fire, though it was late spring and the house already quite warm. Then he sat by the sleeping girl and stared. She lay in a curled position for some time. Only the slow pulsing of her back told him that she breathed. But as dusk settled about the house, bringing with it a half-light, the girl gave a sudden sigh and stretched. Then she sat up and stared. Her arms went out before her as if she were swimming in the air. Jan wondered for a moment if she were blind. Then the girl leaped up in one fluid movement and began to sway, to dance upon the hearthstones. Her feet beat swiftly, and she turned round and round in dizzying circles. She stopped so suddenly that Jan's head still spun. He saw that she was now perfectly dry, except for one side of her shift. The left hem and skirt were still damp and remained molded against her. "Turn again," Jan whispered hoarsely, suddenly afraid. The girl looked at him and did not move. When he saw that she did not understand his tongue, Jan walked over to her and led her back to the fire. Her hand was quite cold in his, but she smiled shyly up at him. She was small, only chest high, and Jan himself was not a large man. Her skin, even in the darkening house, was so white it glowed with a fierce light. Jan could see the rivulets of her veins where they ran close to the surface, at her wrists and temples. He stayed with her by the fire until the heat made him sweat. But though she stood silently, letting the fire warm her first one side and then the other, her skin remained cold, and the left side of her shift would not dry. Jan knelt down before her and touched the damp hem. He put his cheek against it.
"Hutta," he cried at last, "I know you now. You are a river maid, a water spirit. I have heard of such. I believed in them when I was a child."
The water girl smiled steadily down at him and touched his hair with her fingers, twining the strands round and about as if weaving a spell. Jan felt the touch, cold and hot, burn its way down the back of his head and along his spine. He remembered with dread all the old tales. To hold such a one against her will meant death. To love such a one meant despair. He shook his head violently, and her hand fell away. How foolish, Jan thought. Old wives and children believe such things. I do not love her, beautiful as she is. And as for the other, how am I to know what is her will? If we cannot talk the same tongue, I can only guess her wants. He rose and went to the cupboard and took out bread and cheese and a bit of salt fish, which he put before her. The water maid ate nothing. Not then or later. She had only a few drops of water before the night settled in. When the moon rose, the river maid began to pace restlessly about the house. From one wall to the other she walked. She went to the window and put her hand against the glass. She stood by the closed door and put her shoulder to the wood, but she would not touch the metal latch. It was then that Jan was sure of her. Cold iron will keep her in. He was determined she would stay at least until morning. The river maid cried all the night, a high keening that rose and fell like waves. But in the morning she seemed accommodated to the house and settled quietly to sleep by the fire. Once in a while she would stretch and stand, the damp left side of her shift clinging to her thigh. In the half light of the hearth she seemed even more beautiful than before. Jan left a bowl of fresh water near the fire with some cress by it before he went to feed the cows. But he checked the latch on the windows and set a heavy iron bar across the outside of the door. "I will let you go tonight," he promised slowly. "Tonight," he said, as if speaking to a child. But she did not know his language and could not hold him to his vow. By the next morning he had forgotten making it. For a year, Jan kept her. He grew to like the wavering sounds she made as she cried each night. He loved the way her eyes turned a deep green when he touched her. He was fascinated by the blue veins that meandered at her throat, along the backs of her knees, and laced each small breast. Her mouth was always cold under his. Fearing the girl might guess the working of window or gate, Jan fashioned iron chains for the glass and an ornate grillwork for the door. In that way he could open them to let in air and let her look out at the sun and moon and seasons changings. But he did not let her go. And as she never learned to speak with him in his tongue and thereby beg for release, Jan convinced himself that she was content. Then it was spring again. Down from the mountains came the swollen streams, made big with melted snow. The river maid drank whole glasses of water now and put on weight. Jan guessed that she carried his child, for her belly grew. She moved slowly and no longer tried to dance. She sat by the window at night with her arms raised and sang strange, wordless tunes, sometimes loud and sometimes soft as a cradle song. Her voice was as steady as the patter of the rain, and underneath Jan fancied he heard a growing strength. His nights became as restless as hers, his sleep full of watery dreams. The night of the full moon, the rain beat angrily against the glass as if insisting on admission. The river maid put her head to one side, listening. Then she rose and left her window place. She stretched and put her hands to her back, then traced them slowly around her sides to the front. She moved heavily to the hearth and sat. Bracing both hands on the stones behind her, she spread her legs, crooked at the knees. Jan watched as her belly rolled in great waves under the tight white shift. She threw her head back, gasped at the air, and then, with a great cry of triumph, expelled the child. It rode a gush of water between her legs and came to rest at Jan's feet. It was small and fish-like, with a translucent tail. It looked up at him with blue eyes that were covered with a veil of skin. The skin lifted once, twice, then closed again as the child slept. Jan cried because it was a beast. At that very moment, the river outside gave a shout of release. With the added waters from the rain and snow, it had the strength to push through the earth dam in a single wave that gathered force as it rolled. It rushed across the meadow, through the farmyard and barn, and overwhelmed the house. It broke the iron gates and grills as if they were brittle sticks, washing them away in its flood. Then it settled back into its old course, tumbling over familiar rocks and rounding the curves it had cut in its youth. When the neighbors came the next day to assess the damage, they found no trace of the house or Jan. "Gone," said one. "A bad end," said another. "Never change a river," said a third. They spat through their fingers and made other signs against evil. Then they went home to their own fires and gave it no more thought. But a year later, in a pocket of the river, in a quiet place said to house a great fish with a translucent tail, an inquisitive boy found a jumble of white bones. His father and the other men guessed the bones to be Jan's, and they left them to the river instead of burying them. When the boy asked why, his father said, "Chuta, hush, boy, and listen." The boy listened and heard the river playing merrily over the bones. It was a high, sweet, bubbling song, and anyone with half an ear could hear that the song, though wordless, or at least in a language unknown to men, was full of freedom and a conquering joy.
So that was Jane Yolen's modern fairy tale, The River Maid. And that's it for our show this evening. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you can reach me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. And you can scroll through the archived shows at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk under the Evening Under Lamplight link. And if you get a chance, try to find Daphne Sada and the Voyagers and their album Walking the Thin Line. It's got many other songs, like the one we heard bits in pieces this evening. And now, good night.